Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump is addressing concerns about North Korea's nuclear ambitions. On CBS program Face the Nation this Sunday, Mr. Trump told host John Dickerson that he won't be happy if the North conducts another nuclear test. He also said he doesn't underestimate leader Kim Jong-un.
For the last 100 days,
Mr. Trump said the U.S. cannot let what's been going on for a long period continue, and he said it should have been taken care of by previous administrations, going back as far as former President Bill Clinton. On Saturday, President Trump marked his 100 days in office with a campaign-style rally. He spoke on many of the same themes that got him elected, like making America great again and improving security and bringing back jobs. President Trump has invited Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte to Washington to discuss various issues, including the threat North Korea presents to regional security. North Korea test-fired a ballistic missile early Saturday north of the capital, Pyongyang. Both Washington and Seoul said the test was not successful, but still drew widespread international condemnation.
Un lavoro di risolvere i problemi sulla strada della diplomazia. E ci sono i facilitatori, tanti nel mondo.
Pope Francis said Saturday that the nuclear test in crisis in North Korea has heated up too much, and he warned that a war with the isolated nation would destroy a good part of humanity. More can be found at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Turkey has passed two new decrees, one that expelled more than 4,000 civil servants and another that banned television dating programs. State of emergency that followed last summer's coup attempt has allowed the Turkish government to rule by decrees. And since then, more than 47,000 people have been arrested. 100,000 have been purged for alleged connections to terror organizations. U.S. Marines have returned to Afghanistan's southern Helmand province 3 years after NATO ended its combat mission in the country. Marines and NATO forces attended a ceremony Saturday marking the handover of the Helmand Command in the poppy-growing rest of province. Instead of fighting this time, the Marines have been tapped to train, advise, and assist Afghan security forces who are struggling to drive out the Taliban insurgents. Their return comes a day after the Taliban announced the launch of a spring offensive against Afghan forces.
I was excited to come back because, you know, I have a lot of time invested in Helmand Province. You know, we've many, many years of combat operations, and we hate to see the region become unstable. And coming back here and be able to help and actually stabilize the region is very exciting.
That's Marines Staff Sergeant George Caldwell. Eight Syrian rescuers, known as the White Helmets, were killed Saturday when an airstrike hit their office in the rebel-held Hama province. It was unclear who carried out the attack. The Syrian army, backed by Russia and Iran in the six-year-old war, has been making a push in recent weeks to regain rebel-held areas such as Hama province. The European Union has voted unanimously to adopt guidelines to negotiate Britain's exit from the EU. The 27 leaders voted to approve the guidelines in less than 15 minutes. European Council President Donald Tusk said several steps have to be taken before Brexit negotiations can begin.
Before negotiating our future relations with the UK, we must first achieve sufficient progress on citizens' rights, finances, and the border issue in Ireland.
Prince Harry has joined thousands of rugby fans at a London stadium to cheer on the annual British Armed Forces rugby match. The 32-year-old prince, a former army captain, was attending the 100th edition of the annual match between senior teams from the Army and the Royal Navy. Harry was at the match in his role as patron of the Invictus Games Foundation, a charity for this year's game. He has spearheaded the Invictus Games, an international sporting event for injured service personnel. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
From what has transpired in those trials, several of them have stated on record under oath that they were doing that with the full knowledge of the former president.
Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika accuses his predecessor of allegedly looting public funds.
He's, I think, 72, and he's nearing the cut-off limit of the presidency in Kenya, and therefore I think this one formed one of the compelling reasons.
The biggest Kenyan opposition coalition chooses former Prime Minister Raila Odinga to face incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta in the upcoming August poll.
Pope Francis said Mass in Latin to a vast throng of worshippers gathered at Egypt's Air Force Stadium Saturday.
And Pope Francis concludes a 27-hour visit to Egypt. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika has accused his predecessor of complicity in the alleged looting of public funds. The president's remark came at a national dialogue on corruption in the capital Lilongwe Friday. Mutharika says former President Joyce Banda was the mastermind behind the massive looting of public funds during her term in office. But supporters of the former president say this is yet another attempt by the president to tarnish the reputation of his predecessor. To learn more about the Malawian corruption combat, I read presidential spokesman Ngeme Kalirani.
His Excellency, the President, Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika, was just stating a matter of fact that is before the courts. As if you've been following what has been going on in trials pertaining to the cash gate, which is the systematic looting of public coffers, which happened between 2012 and 2013 under President Dr. Joyce Banda's time, several suspects have been convicted. They are now convicts and they are serving various jail terms. And from what has transpired in those trials, several of them have stated on record under oath that they were doing that with the full knowledge of the former president.
If this is what is recorded in the court and the president is aware of this, why hasn't the president gone after the former president in terms of extradition to face justice in Malawi instead of just saying it for the sake of doing so?
Yeah, that's a very important question, but you have to appreciate our judicial system in Malawi. The way our judicial system operates in Malawi is such that it is entirely independent of the executive, which is headed by the president. In Malawi, we have several prosecuting authorities. These matters under Cashgate are being prosecuted, most of them under the Anti-Corruption Bureau. And in our setup in Malawi, the Anti-Corruption Bureau operates completely independent of instructions from the president. It is up to them to look at the evidence before them and to decide on the timing of the prosecution, which they would do, prefer to do and at what time. It is not up to the president to make such a decision.
Supporters of the former president, Dr. Joyce Banda, are saying that this is purely a witch hunt. Since President Mutharika came into power, he basically has targeted her and accused her of a slew of wrongdoings, including this cash gate, and possibly have colluded with these people who have been convicted of involving themselves in this scandal just to tarnish her reputation as the former president, as an opponent of President Mutharika. What do you say to that?
That is completely outrageous. Well, these are matter of facts. The cash gate looting of public coffers, as a matter of fact, happened between 2012 and 2013. And it is a matter of fact that during this period, former President Joyce Banda was the president. Further, there are several former ministers from Dr. Joyce Banda's administration that have been implicated in this scandal. Some are serving jail terms right now. And some of them have said it is their former president, Joyce Banda, who happens also to be the president of their party, who had instructed them to do this. President Dr. Joyce Banda left the country 3 years ago. Immediately she lost power. Immediately this Cashgate scandal came to light. She left the country. She hasn't been in Malawi for the past 3 years. And speculations are bound to happen. Why is she not coming back?
President Mutharika said that there is a perception that corruption is worsening currently. How is this fight against corruption, since Malawians themselves are saying, and he admits, that this is the perception that corruption has worsened during his presidency?
The president also said that this particular perception is being promoted by most of the people that are answering charges now. You know, the nature of corruption is such that once, as a leadership, you decide to pounce on individuals that have been benefiting from corruption, they have a tendency to fight back, because you're fighting individuals that have access to rooted funds. You are fighting individuals that had networks in the government systems. So they don't go down so easily.
Ngemi Kalirani is the spokesman for Malawian President Hathapitha Mutharika. He spoke with me from Lilongwe. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni in March issued a directive to install CCTV cameras in major towns and on highways to curb crime in the East African country. The directive followed a spiral of murders in the last 4 years, including an Assistant Inspector General of Police last month. Kaniya Obiga is the Ugandan Minister of State for Internal Affairs. For VOA, he spoke with reporter Halima Atumani about how far they have gone with implementing the presidential directive.
This financial year, what we are going to do is complete our research. If possible, we are already looking for the sources of purchase, the kind of machines that we should buy, and the functions that they perform. And we hope that by the end of the next financial year, we should be able to install some.
I understand you need about 103 billion Uganda shillings to just purchase these cameras. Do we have that money?
As we have said, we are going to do it in the major cities, the major roads, and the municipalities and the towns. So it is inevitably something which will be done in phases. And we think we can start with the first phase of 60 billion. And since this is a priority, we'll have to find that money.
Has this directive been enabled by law, or we are just following what the president has said?
No. There is nothing illegal about this process. We're not going to install them in people's houses. This is just a routine check, just like you put a traffic person on the road, except this time we want to use the, instead of the human eye, we are also looking at the machine eye.
Honorable Minister, currently we have so many groups that are terrorizing Ugandans. They are throwing leaflets, say, and listing names of people saying we are coming. They beat people up. They cut people up. Do you think, as a ministry that oversees the police, you are in charge of this country's security?
Oh, yeah, sure. We are completely in charge of the security of this country. First of all, these thugs started these activities sometime last year. And once we went in there, we sensitized the population and the others, we more or less flushed them out of there. Many of them have now got their roots in the city, which even makes it much easier, because now the city is more managed, we have more security forces in the city, we have identified these groups, and we have in fact arrested quite a number of them right now, a number of them, about 50. They are in the courts of law.
This week we saw the chief of police parade some suspects, and one of them came out to say our planned meetings for these robberies or these attacks we make on people are actually protected by the police. Was this not shocking to you?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, first of all, it is shocking that we don't expect that of a professional police person as an individual. But no, because the police is also made of human beings. And within the police, we can't say everybody's 100% perfect. There are obviously criminals or people who are criminal with criminal tendencies within the police. But I must say, this is a very, very small number. Right now, we have a very good cooperation from the public. They give us information. So those elements are there. And we are very happy That individual who was arrested actually managed to tell us, that there are people within the police. That provides a second point of investigation.
We tend to do things as a knee-jerk reaction. Police boss has been killed, then we think about cameras. Do we have a larger plan to ensure that we will get to the root cause of insecurity in the country?
We do have that plan. You see, the issue of the CCTV cameras is not something which was part of by the recent killings or the killing of a senior police officer. No. About 2 years back, this issue was muted. Said we have an opportunity of data in the NIRA, that is National Identification Registration Authority, which has got the identities of every individual, where they come from, their physical features and all that. So police or the Minister of Internal Affairs in the element of security said, this is where we can get in and use it. And one of the best ways to couple this is really to make sure that we have cameras which can capture people not only in doing bad things, but also in doing good things and know who is doing a good thing.
Kania Obiga is the Ugandan Minister of State for Internal Affairs. For VOA, he spoke with Halima Atumani from the capital, Kampala. The Kenyan Main Opposition Alliance has chosen former Prime Minister Raila Odinga as its candidate to face President Uhuru Kenyatta in the August polls. But Odinga has his work cut out for him after some supporters expressed displeasure that their preferred candidates were not chosen. This after Francis Nyenzi, the minority leader of the National Assembly, said his team got a raw deal. He said it will be difficult to convince other ethnic groups to vote for the former prime minister in the upcoming election. For the latest development, I reached Kenyan political analyst Michael Ole Tiampati in the capital, Nairobi.
To many people, it did not come as a surprise because a number of factors were working in favor of Raila, one of them being that this would be his last shot at the presidency because of the age factor. You know, he's, I think, 72, and he's nearing the cutoff limit of the presidency in Kenya, and therefore I think this one formed one of the compelling reasons for him to be granted that opportunity. Secondly, there were rumors that he had promised to be a one-term president, and probably also this one served to justify his case, as well as the fact that he had unflinching support from Moses Wetangula and Isaac Ruto. So to some of us, it didn't come as a surprise.
The National Assembly Minority Leader Francis Nyenzi is displeased with the choice of Raila Odinga as the presidential candidate of NASA. He said that the Kamba nation, from where Kalonzo Musyoka comes, might not be pleased and might not even be enthusiastic enough to vote for Raila Odinga in the presidential election, which some argue will pave the way for the incumbent.
It must be said that we have witnessed a number of hardline positions taken by almost all the principals, as they are called. And of course, I think Nyenzi has come out as one of the most prolific hardliner within the Kalonzo faction. While at the same time, there was also some hardline positions that had been taken by Moses Wetangula initially, with the Luhya Nation also saying that they were not prepared to get anything short of the presidency. There are a number of factors here that must be considered because both ways, we know that there is that potential risk that probably the Kamba Nation may not necessarily come out and vote overwhelmingly because of the feeling that they have been cheated out of a shot at the presidency. Secondly, also, there is the fact that probably with a Raila presidency, he stands better chance, probably an 70-80% chance.
Looking at how ethnocentric people vote in Kenya, do you think NASA, led by Raila Odinga, would be able to come up with a strategy to appease these disgruntled supporters ahead of the elections?
This provides for a very interesting case study because, again, I think what NASA is riding on, the platform of inclusivity, social and economic justice. And I think one of the strategies that NASA probably is working on right now is to try and tame some of the hardline lieutenants within its coalition, because those are the ones that may be voicing opinions that may end up consolidating the positions of those that are that feel disgruntled, and probably cause a fallout, which would eventually probably cost the NASA the presidency. So there is a lot of work to be done, and I think currently strategies are being put in place to try and calm those dissenting voices.
Michael Oletiampati is a Kenyan political analyst. He spoke with me from Nairobi. The Ghanaian finance minister says President Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo is committed to fighting corruption. Ken Oforiatta says the administration in Accra has been implementing measures to plug loopholes to prevent financial wrongdoing. This, he says, forms part of the effort to crack down on corruption. In part two of my interview with him, Finance Minister Oforiatta says the government also seeks to jumpstart the faltering economy it inherited by implementing policies to ensure a business-friendly environment as well as create jobs for Ghanaians.
Well, plugging the loopholes, first of all, but more importantly, we have the Public Finance Management Act, the PFMA, which has not been applied much. So we have very liberally distributed this act to all ministries, departments, and agencies, letting them know that there will be clear sanctions if people commit government, such that we don't get commitments like the $7 billion we found when we came in, and that we are there when any commitments are being done. So that's important. So the Ministry of Finance, if there is any legacy that we want to leave, will be to have a global standard Treasury, Risk Management, and Public Finance Management Act divisions, which then ensures that we tackle the issues of misappropriation by MDAs. But significantly, the Special Prosecutor Bill has been drafted, and with the next parliament, it will go into parliament, and that will begin the process of also bring into book those who might have misappropriated government funds.
So how do you plan to ensure macro stability to boost the economy that will attract investment? Of course, you've met some investors here. How do you plan doing that?
I think that local investors are very, very significant because in the end, you want to create a Ghana that is owned by Ghanaians, and so that's key. But you need your matrices and indices to come down, inflation to come down, which means food, etc., and therefore the investment in agriculture is expected to do that. You need your interest rates, etc., to come down, which means that revenues, in a sense, must begin to exceed our expenditure. So that you don't have the deficit, which means that we go in to borrow and we crowd out the private sector. So we have our eyes keenly on that. Beyond the fact that the IMF is also expecting that type of discipline, if we ourselves knowing that to create a robust economy, we need to manage our expenses and increase our revenues. And I think you have a team that is competent and has the energy to do that. You also, in the same vein, and that is why we are out here, need to let investors know that we are ready to do business and that Ghana is back. Because with a budget deficit, meaning the country has little savings, of corporates not making money last year, they don't have savings, and of individuals not being paid a living wage, they also don't have savings. So you need to attract foreign entrepreneurs or businesses to come in to fill that gap to help the economy to grow.
You recently presented the budget to Parliament. What would you say are the key areas, if immediately tackled, could see an improvement in the lives of Ghanaians who voted for you, of course, since, as you know, voters rejected the previous administration for being unable to meet their aspirations? What would you do differently?
Well, it's what we call the budget was sowing the seeds for growth and jobs, and the mantra these days is Ghana beyond aid. What are we going to do to have fiscal sovereignty? And that's what we intend. I think the budget encapsulates in a certain sense what the manifesto wanted, which is freeing Ghanaians to do what they do best. I think there's no better solution to growth than that. For people to feel their citizenhood, be responsible for themselves and the country. And really, in the final analysis, Peter, there has to be a sense of care for the public purse. Once we do that and everybody has ownership in that, you'll be surprised what we'll be talking about in a year or so. A Ghana that is shining, that is glimmering, whose shoulders are up, a confident people, and just taking the world over.
Ken Oforiatta is the Ghanaian finance minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Pope Francis concluded a 27-hour visit to Egypt Saturday after delivering Mass to a crowd of 25,000 Catholics and visiting a seminary. Preaching a message of peace, the pontiff tried to reach out to both Christians and Muslims, denouncing those who preach violence in the name of God. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Pope Francis said Mass in Latin to a vast throng of worshippers gathered at Egypt's Air Force Stadium Saturday amid strict security. Egyptian media reported the 25,000 Catholic Christians from six branches of the church attended the Mass amid a festive atmosphere. Choir of Armenian Catholics took its turn to sing during the Saturday Mass as Pope Francis made an effort to embrace Catholics from the different branches of his own church. Other choirs sang in Arabic and Latin.
إِنَّ ذِيَارَتَكُمْ لِمِصْرِ الْغَالِيَةِ وَاسْتِقْبَالِ شَعْبِهَا
Patriarch Ibrahim Ishaq, head of the Catholic branch of the Coptic Church, summed up the papal visit, saying that it was taking place under the banner of the Pope of Peace in the Land of Peace. Egypt, he stressed, is the cradle of religions and will remain a land of peace. Pope Francis spent the first day of his visit Friday meeting with the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar University at an interfaith dialogue conference before visiting the head of the Coptic Orthodox Church, Pope Tewodros, to express his condolences over the Palm Sunday suicide attacks at Coptic churches in Alexandria and the Nile Delta town of Tanta. The pontiff told Muslim and Christian leaders at Friday's dialogue meeting that we must learn from the past and that violence breeds more violence and evil only begets evil. Grand Imam Sheikh Ahmed Tayyib, who presided over the conference with Pope Francis, decried what he called the unprecedented barbarity of the 21st century, despite all the talk of human rights. Both leaders embraced each other warmly after addressing the crowd. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who also attended the gathering, insisted that Egypt is at the forefront of those countries fighting terrorism and urged the international community to sanction countries which finance terrorism and help to recruit terrorists. Tourism Minister Yahya Rashid told Egyptian media that he thinks that Pope Francis' visit demonstrates to the world that Egypt is a safe and hospitable place to visit. He says that Egypt is not only the cradle of civilizations, but also has a major role in delivering a message of peace to the world. Pope Francis' final stop before heading to the airport was a visit to a seminary in the Cairo suburb of Ma'adi, where he appealed to clergy from different Christian sects to accept the differences among us, in the same way that we admire the different virtues of St. Peter and of St. Paul. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with boxing. British Anthony Joshua defeated Vladimir Klitschko in London late Saturday to win the WBA and IBO heavyweight titles, in addition to his IBF title. In front of an electric crowd of 90,000 at London's Wembley Stadium, Joshua scored a pair of knockdowns in round 11 to finish off an incredibly game Klitschko by taking a knockout in a bout that marked the former champion's return after losing his trio of world titles 17 months ago. The 27-year-old Joshua, a rising star who won gold for England at the 2012 London Olympics, made the third defense of his IBF title and picked up the vacant WBA belt in the process. But he was forced to overcome severe adversity to get there after running out of gas and suffering a mid-fight knockdown, the first of his young career. In football, TP Mazembe of DR Congo first trips South Africa, Guinea and Gabon as they beat to defend their Confederation Cup title. The five-time African champions have been drawn in a pool with SuperSport United, Haroya and Monana in the expanded group stage. Three-time winners CS Sfaxien of Tunisia will face South Africa's Platinum Stars, debutants Mbabane Swallows of Swaziland and Mouladia Algal of Algeria. Moroccan side FUS Rabat, who won the tournament in 2010, faced two sides making their debuts in the group stages in Rivers United of Nigeria and Uganda's KCCA. The group is completed by Tunisia's Club Africain, who were crowned continental champions in 1991 and runners-up in this competition 20 years later. The other group has Zesco United of Zambia, Recreative Libolo of Angola, Al Hilal Obeid of Sudan, and Smoha of Egypt. The first group matches will be played on the weekend of May 12th to 14th. The two top teams from each group will progress to the quarterfinals, with the final set to be played over two legs in November. Meanwhile, title holders South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns have been handed a tricky draw for the group stage of this year's Africa Champions League. As well as debutant St. George of Ethiopia in Group C, they will face Esperance of Tunisia and DR Congo's AS Vita Club, who have both been continental champions in the past. Sudan's two biggest clubs have been drawn in Group A as Al Hilal and El Merk are joined by Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia and Mozambique's Ferroviario Beira. Group D has Al Ahly of Egypt, Wydad Casablanca of Morocco, Cotton Sport of Cameroon and Zenaco of Zambia. Zimbabwean debutants Caps United, who beat five-time champion TP Mazembe of DR Congo, are in Group B, alongside last year's runners-up Zamalek of Egypt, Algeria's USM Alger, and Al Ahly Tripoli of Libya. And another Kenyan high-profile athlete has failed a doping test just weeks after Rio Olympics marathon champion Jemina Samgong tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs. According to the chairman of Athletics Kenya, the sport's global governing body, IAAF, had found a positive test but said that the identity of the athlete could not be revealed. Kenya's middle and long distance success has been marred by doping cases involving elite athletes. Officials estimate the number of positive tests at about 50 in the past 4 years. News of the test comes after Samgong, who last year became the first Kenyan woman to win Olympic gold in the marathon, tested positive for the banned blood booster EPO in an out-of-competition test carried out by IAAF. Doping was made a criminal offense in Kenya in June 2016.
It's reported that IAAF rejected Sam Gong's explanation about the circumstances that led to her positive test. The 32-year Sam Gong was among six Kenyan gold medalists in Rio, which was the country's best performance at the Olympics. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again on Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Make we scatter this place tonight. Dance and sweat till life's in a fight. We must settle this thing tonight. Yeah. Come, let us catch some feelings for night. If you tell me, say, make a hello, hello, hello. I don't go waste time, but to do like so. Hello, hello. Divide in the joke, this go. Hey, this love and love, it no be chop and go. Hey, but because of you, hey, I get to go. Because of you, eh, I get to go strong. This feeling got me falling. All over. Get out of something they do me for body, oh. All over. I make you spend this money, oh. All over. This one I can lead Julie and Romeo. Original, a bungalow. Because of you, eh, I get to go strong. This feeling got me falling. All over. Get out of something they do me for body, oh. All over. I make you spend this money, oh. Because of you, eh, I get to go strong. This feeling got me falling. All over. Get out of something they do me for body, oh. All over. I make you spend this money, oh.
No. Nobody ugly, oh. Chaka, biko idika madi izi enwe kadaka, eh.
they deceive you. Hey, as you there for Twitter, your name for Insta, sexy for delicious twister. Hey, why you do the lie? When nothing there to the shake you, where they waste you. As you there for Twitter, your name for Insta, sexy for delicious twister. Hey, why you do the shy? Shopping, take a selfie, tag em, tag em. You post them up, they tag your magam, tag em, tag em. You day they for me, go ye when you day you badger. Now who you day deceive you? Hey, you see G-Wagon, tag em. You day big mansion, tag em. Even for toilet mirror, tag em. Snapchatting video, tag em.
You give me pain up because of what you're going through. There's no better way to explain to you than to tell you the world has a place for you. I know you're a star and you were meant to tell all of your neighbors and your friends too. Don't take long, listen to the song, spread love to another. You can't go wrong.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. We have all become accustomed to the tradition of assessing the first 100 days of heads of state and government. So it is with the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. In fact, many candidates running for office these days would give indications of what they hope to achieve in the first 100 days. Yesterday was the 100th day of Donald Trump. And the general assessment is that legislatively, it has not achieved very much, even though the Senate was able to approve the appointment of a new Supreme Justice, but under rules which may come to haunt the Republicans in the future, the so-called nuclear measures. But President Trump has been the most prolific in signing executive action, mainly dealing with regulations on all sorts of matters, but mainly reducing regulation imposed under President Obama. There has been also the issue of the Muslim ban, which was part of executive action. Here, the federal courts have blocked this action, the two versions issued by President Trump, believing that they may be contrary to the U.S. Constitution. There has also been another block by federal courts of decisions made to impose financial penalties on U.S. cities, which are called sanctioned cities, that refuse to comply with the federal government in the expulsion of illegal immigrants to different countries, particularly in Mexico. Nothing has been done with the wall. The wall was a major pronouncement of the president, build the wall. It is now very clear that even if the wall is built, Mexico is not going to pay for that wall. There has been a change in the dealings with China. Currency manipulation is out of the window. NAFTA is now not going to be abolished, but to be renegotiated. But what is also very important during the 100 days is the development and sustenance of the so-called resistance movement, which has been very, very, very strong, even when compared to that under Obama, with the Republicans opposing it during the time of Obama. And this resistance movement shows that the Democrats are much more active in resisting the programs of President Trump. Where he has received some approval on both sides of the aisle among Democrats and Republicans is the use and projection of force. He fired 59 Tomahawk missiles in Syria. They used the so-called massive mother of all weapons in Afghanistan, and there have been constant threats in the Korean Peninsula, jingoistic remarks by the president, and these have won generally some approval. And it is so surprising that this has been the case, given the fact that the late Senator Fulbright once gave a speech in the Senate during the Vietnam era about the use of the arrogance of power as a danger. It may be timely for the media and pundits to revisit that speech in this very critical time. The problem now is what will happen in the next 100 days. The Speaker of the House of Representatives suggested that instead of talking about 100 days, it should be 200 days. He believes that there are prospects to achieve some legislation in the second 100 days. But this is not a guarantee that this could be done, because the problem is there is great division in the United States between the Democrats and the Republicans. The question for the president is whether or not he will continue with his Twitter exercises, which has caused so much problem. He has talked about having a tax plan, but what has been published is not so much a plan, but a talking point about tax reform. And in the last few days, there were reports of the growth rate was very tepid, and it is no guarantee of a 3% growth which will sustain a tax cut in a neutral stage. So this is an area where one has to work and see whether there could be some progress with the Democrats, particularly in issues like the infrastructure. So for us to see what will happen, just stay tuned. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. We'll be right back. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sale, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when the roots of a tree begin to decay, it spreads death to the branches. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every month, the UN Security Council holds a discussion on Middle East issues that has become an opportunity for council members to routinely bash Israel. That is, until now. At this month's open debate on the Middle East, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley criticized this absurdly biased and painfully narrow formula. These meetings do nothing to bring the parties closer together, she said. Peace between Israel and the Palestinians will only come from direct negotiations, not from one-sided Security Council meetings and one-sided resolutions. Ambassador Haley urged her colleagues in the Security Council to speak honestly about the various conflicts in the Middle East. To do so, she said, we need to start with the chief culprit, Iran, and its partner militia, Hezbollah. Ambassador Haley stated that in Lebanon, Hezbollah, a terrorist organization, uses towns to shield its arsenals of tens of thousands of illegal rockets. In Syria, Iran's militias stand side by side with Syrian troops as they slaughter the Syrian people. At times, Hezbollah is commanding Bashar al-Assad's fighters. Reportedly, it is even recruiting Syrian children to indoctrinate a new generation with its toxic ideology. Hezbollah is a terrorist group spreading its influence across the Middle East with the backing of a state sponsor. Iran and Hezbollah are working together to expand extremist ideologies in the Middle East, Ambassador Haley said. That is the threat that should be dominating our discussion at the Security Council. In response to the threat, the United States imposed targeted sanctions on Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Quds Force and Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security for their support of the Assad regime. The U.S. has designated members of Iranian-backed terrorist organizations in Bahrain. In addition, the U.S. continues to vigorously enforce sanctions against Iran, including those related to Iran's support for terrorism and destabilizing regional activities. Iran's ballistic missile tests defy Security Council resolutions and further undermine the stability in the region, Ambassador Haley said. We call on all states to fully implement Resolution 2231, which strictly circumscribes the transfer of weapons to and from Iran, as well as the arms embargoes against the Houthis in Resolutions 2216 and for Lebanon in Resolution 1701. The incredibly destructive nature of Iranian and Hezbollah activities throughout the Middle East demands much more of our attention, Ambassador Haley said. It should become this council's priority in the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.